I guess that most of you, if not all of you, will have heard about the record-breaking exploits of the American swimmer Michael Phelps. His career has ended at this London Olympic Games on 22 Olympic medals. It's staggering, isn't it? And an astonishing 18 of those have been gold. But seeing Phelps again this time round reminded me of a great moment from the coverage of the Beijing Olympics 4 years ago, where Phelps won a remarkable 8 gold medals. And for some reason, a guy called Steve Parry, who was a British swimmer, I think in Athens, and maybe before that, he was a BBC pundit in Beijing, and for whatever reason, he'd been asked to walk through the Olympic Park with a cardboard cutout of Michael Phelps. And despite bearing only the very slightest resemblance to Michael Phelps, crowds and crowds and crowds of the Chinese people were absolutely convinced that this was the great, the legendary Michael Phelps before them, rather than the somewhat less famous Steve Parry, with, I think, one fourth place finish on his Olympic CV. And so in this coverage, poor Steve Parry was just swamped by vast crowds of the public crowding around him. They were taking pictures of him. They were pleading with him for autographs. And again and again, and there's a YouTube clip you should check out, where he's just in vain saying to them, "I'm not Michael Phelps. I'm not Michael Phelps. I'm Steve Parry from Great Britain. I'm not Michael Phelps." And his voice is lost in this kind of frenzy of Chinese support. Now, that was a really trivial case of mistaken identity. I don't think it really mattered in the end that Steve Parry was taking all the praise and the plaudits that should have been going to Michael Phelps. But in this story tonight, we've got a much, much more significant case of mistaken identity. There's an identity crisis going on in this story, because it's a story about whom the real God is. It's about whether the praise and the plaudits that should be going to him are going to lesser fake imitations. Now, just before we get stuck into the text, we need to understand some of the story so far. 1 Kings, the period that it covers, begins with the reign of King Solomon. And for a little while, everything is rosy in Israel. And the kingdom is strong, it's united, and the good times are rolling for the people. But it all starts to go horribly wrong when, bit by bit, Solomon starts to worship not the God of the Bible, not the God of Israel, but the foreign gods of the nations around them. And the time comes when God basically says, enough's enough, and he steps in and he breaks up the kingdom. So it's divided into Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And as 1 and 2 Kings unfold, it's an incredibly depressing, bleak picture as the narrative spotlight swings back and forth between the north and the south. And if you were here last Sunday evening, Tim really helpfully pointed out that it's as though their kings are in competition to see who can take sin to ever lower depths. And by the time we get to chapter 17 and 18, the king on the throne is Ahab. And I'd like you to flick back to the end of chapter 16, if you would, because it's worth reading at the end of that chapter to see the kind of guy that Ahab was. So I'm going to read verses 29 to 33 of the end of chapter 16. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. All is not well in Israel. So God steps in and he does what he had repeatedly warned that he would do. Chapter 17, verse 1, through Elijah he pronounces a drought. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word. And that proves exactly to be the case. So for the next 3 years, in the hosepipe ban to end all hosepipe bans, there is not a drop for the entire nation until we get to chapter 18 and verse 1. Have a look at it with me. After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. So the Lord decides, I'm going to send rain again. But here's what's strange. It takes until verse 45 of this chapter before we eventually read, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, and a heavy rain came on. Why doesn't it say that in verse 2? Why doesn't the Lord say, look, I'm going to bring rain again, verse 2, the clouds came and the rain fell? The answer is because God wants every last person in the nation to be in no doubt whatsoever about who the real God is. If God had just, as it were, turned the rain back on, all of the people would have just assumed that Baal had made a comeback, that he'd been rejuvenated, and they'd have continued in this same sorry illusion that Baal was king. And the God of the Bible is not willing to let that happen. So between this announcement that the rain is going to return and the rain actually coming, what we have is a showdown. There must first be a face-off. There must be a God contest. This is the gold medal match in the identity of God event. Will the real God please stand up? So we're going to see three features as we look at this contest. The challenge to choose, the failure of false gods, and the triumph of the true God. So the challenge to choose. Verse 21 is really, really key in this narrative. It's really the question that forms the backdrop to the whole event. Elijah, in the first part of this section, has gathered the people from all over Israel. And he's got them to meet on Mount Carmel. And all of Joe Public are there, and all of the prophets of Baal are there, and all of the prophets of Asherah. Everyone is there. And with this colossal crowd, if you can imagine it, they're already in their seats. Elijah poses a question that went down about as well as it would go down today. Look at verse 21. Elijah went before the people and said, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. But the people said nothing. Now Elijah is saying something very politically incorrect. He's posing a question that most people in our culture don't think needs to be asked, or even should be asked. What's he saying? He's saying you need to choose your God. Fence sitting is not an option. Trying to take a blurry middle ground, hedge your bets kind of position when it comes to God is not an option. But he goes even further than that. More than that, he's saying you need to choose your God based on truth. Notice what he doesn't say in that verse. He doesn't say, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord suits you, follow him. If Baal suits you, follow him. He doesn't say anything like that. He says, if the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. In other words, you need to choose your God, and you need to choose based on which is true and which is false, on which is real and which is not. And that is very countercultural, isn't it? The current thinking in our society is believe what you want. It's about preference rather than truth. And what matters is whether or not it works for you rather than whether or not it is real. So you just find whatever path you wish to find. Elijah's challenge here is cutting right against the grain of that. He's saying you need to choose. And he's absolutely right for lots of reasons. But let me give you just one, because there's too much other stuff in this passage to stay on this long. Let me tell you one reason why our contemporary thinking doesn't work. It's because it's guilty of doing the very thing it says you must not do. So the average person today, I think, seems to be saying, nobody has the right to say that they are right. Nobody has the right to say that their faith is right and everyone else's is wrong. We can't say that, can we? That's the big cultural no-no. You must instead say all beliefs are equally valid. But in saying that, they're really making the very kind of truth claim that they're forbidding anyone else to make. Because what they're saying is this: the only belief you are allowed to have is the belief that all beliefs are equally valid. And all other views are wrong. You see? That's the only belief you're allowed to have. It is just as much of a claim to exclusive truth as Christianity saying Jesus Christ is the only way. Let me put it another way if you're more of a visual person. I guess you've heard the view or the analogy that view will use of the mountain. So they'll say that all these different beliefs and religions and philosophies out there, they all think that they're the right way and that everyone else is the wrong way. But that's because they can't see that they're all just different paths up the same mountain. And all of them reach the same summit in the end. So we just all need to say everyone's okay, we're all going to get to the top in the end, we're all on the same mountain. Now that sounds really plausible, doesn't it? It sounds very tolerant, it sounds very open-minded. But the people who say that, what are they saying? They're saying that we're the only ones who can see the whole mountain. No one else can really see. You're all there with your own little path. Only we have the vantage point from which we can see that you're all on the same mountain. We've got it right, and no one else has. You see, in other words, you cannot avoid making a truth claim. Everyone is making a truth claim. So what we need to do is what Elijah challenges us to do. We're all choosing. We need to choose the one that's actually true and the one that's really real. So how do we know? Well, let's see how the contest plays out, because stamped over this story we find the failure of false gods. I don't know whether you picked it up when it was being read. Maybe you know the story from previous times. But one of the things I love about this event is the sheer number of ridiculous advantages that Elijah gives to Baal and his team. First, he gives them territorial advantage. You know, the choice of Mount Carmel was not a random pick. It wasn't a coincidence. Mount Carmel was slap bang in Baal's heartland. This was on ground that was sacred to Baal. So when Elijah says, look, we're going to have this showdown on Mount Carmel, he's saying, I'm giving you home advantage. I'm going to play the away leg here. We're playing this match on your turf. Perhaps like me, you've lost count of the times through the Olympics you've heard British athletes interviewed. And they say to them, you know, what was it like having the home crowd behind you? And they use all the cliches about the 12th man and all that kind of stuff. But they've been saying that this partisan crowd, this home advantage, gives them that extra boost. You know, Elijah is saying, we're going to play this out in Baal's backyard. He gives a territorial advantage. Next is a numerical advantage. Before you even get to the masses of general public that are in this scene, there are 450 of Baal's gang and just one on the Lord's side. Now look at verse 22. Elijah's really, really keen to point this out. He says, I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. And just in case they've missed it, in verse 25, choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. You know, I was thinking that is such an encouragement to us, because as we'll see, God's power is not dependent upon how many supporters he has. God's power isn't dependent on where he features in the popularity ratings. I don't know about you, but I really feel like we're a minority, and actually increasingly like we're a weak minority. That tide of secularism feels pretty big, doesn't it? Quite weighty, quite intimidating. But this event shows us with crystal clarity that popularity doesn't determine reality. And it feels like that to me a lot. I sometimes feel like, well, surely the masses must be right. Surely, you know, this just is as foolish as everyone says it is. But this passage, this event shows us that it is not always the case that the masses are right. God does not depend on his popularity. Then there is the competitive advantage. It's brilliant, isn't it, what Elijah does when it comes to his turn. Verse 33. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. And then he said to them, fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again, he said, and they did it again. Do it a third time, he ordered, and they did it the third time. The water ran down the altar and even filled the trench. Level playing field? I think not. You know, just again, Olympics has been on my mind. I was thinking what kind of mismatch this would be if this was the track cycling in the velodrome. And I thought this must be like somebody saying to their opponent, I'm going to give you a 20-second head start, and while you go round and round on your state-of-the-art technology bike, I'm going to go round on a child's scooter. It's that kind of ridiculous mismatch. This entire altar and sacrifice and everything around it is drenched. And you don't need to be a physicist to know that wet stuff doesn't burn. So Elijah has, in every possible sense, stacked the odds as far against the Lord as is imaginably possible. I don't know whether they had bookies in those days, but had there been a Mount Carmel bookies, they would have paid out before they got started on a victory for Baal. And yet, despite all of these advantages, this episode is a spectacular failure for Baal and his prophets. Now, I want to highlight for you two marks of false gods. They're demanding and destructive. They've got their bull prepared, these prophets of Baal, and they come out and they shout and they call out to him from morning until noon. There is hour after hour after hour of slavish, persistent shouting. And then we find that when the shouting doesn't work, they decide to play the dancing card. Perhaps a good dance routine is going to twist Baal's arm. And at this stage, it really is all quite comical. You know, you're allowed to laugh at the Bible sometimes. Elijah chips in with some insults. You know, shout louder. Maybe he's deep in thought or busy or on a journey. Maybe he's taking a nap. You know, for some very disappointing reason, the people who translated the NIV have made that much more polite than it really is. They were obviously British people. And when he says he must be busy, he's saying he must be on the toilet. And that's even more polite than what it actually is in the Hebrew. You know, Elijah is having a whale of a time here. You can visualize it, can't you? He's kicking back on the mountain, enjoying the noonday sun, watching this hilarious shouting and dancing, and just relishing the opportunity to throw out his extremely helpful suggestions. It's a comedy scene, but then it gets less funny. Look at verse 28. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. I don't think we're laughing quite so much now because it's a repulsive scene, isn't it? It's a cacophony of noise. It's a frenzy of desperation. The hundreds of men shouting and screaming and slashing at their bodies until Mount Carmel is a river of red. False gods are demanding. They demand that you try and that you strive and that you pour yourself out in increasingly desperate attempts to get them to deliver, to get them to come through for you. But they're also destructive. They'll destroy you. Why? Well, because they'll never deliver. You know, I find the end of verses 26 and 29 to be haunting ones. End of verse 26. But there was no response. No one answered. End of verse 29. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. These men have given their all for Baal. These men have literally shed the blood of their bodies. for Baal. If only we just try a bit harder. If only we just give a bit more. If only we just slash ourselves that bit deeper, he will come through for us. But he never does. Because he's powerless to deliver, and they're left ruined and ultimately destroyed. Now, we're modern 21st century people, and so our default assumption is that these guys are primitive idiots who are into idol worship, and, well, we're all a lot more sophisticated than that, aren't we? Only we're not. You know, we're surrounded by countless numbers of Baals that will draw our worship and draw our striving and draw our blood. We just haven't got the honesty to admit, like these guys did, that they're gods. We don't call them gods, but that's just what they are. So in our culture, they take all kinds of forms. The Baal of career success, the Baal of human approval, the Baal of reputation, the Baal of material possessions, the Baal of money, the Baal of relationships. You know, we're surrounded by gods and their temples. How do you know if they're false? Well, because just like Baal, they will demand and demand and demand and demand of you. And then they will destroy you because they will never deliver. I don't know whether you saw the fascinating documentary about the cyclist Victoria Pendleton before the Olympics began. You know, from the outside, people look at her and say, oh, to have that success and adulation. Oh, to have gold medals hanging around your neck. I would be complete. But from the inside, it looks a little different. Here's what she said. My success has got so great, it's like I'm trapped within it. And she described what happened through her career as her results got bigger and better. Suddenly the responsibility grows and I'm doing it for somebody else. I'm doing it for a program. I'm doing it for the country. I'm doing it for everybody. Isn't that striking? The more she gave herself to success, the more it demanded of her. The more it demanded blood. And the more of it she had, the more trapped she became. She's saying, success didn't free me. Each achievement didn't fulfill me. They simply served to enslave me. The Baal of success. The Baal of fame is a huge one in our culture. You know, vast numbers of young people are signing up for one of this plethora of reality TV shows and contests that are out there. Now, why are they doing it? Just watch any of the episodes, they'll tell you. Because they promise fame. If only I can be famous, if only millions of people around the world will adore me, I'll be complete. Well, I don't think there are many people who have reached higher echelons of fame and fortune than Victoria Beckham. And yet in last week's OK magazine, what's her story? Fame left me feeling emptier than ever. You know, I actually tried to buy OK magazine for the purposes of sermon research, and these are the sacrificial lengths to which I will go. But sadly, it was already on to the next edition when I went back to buy it. But I looked online, and in the sort of summary of the article, Victoria Beckham says, I had thought that being famous would protect me from feeling empty inside, but I'm emptier than ever. I still feel ugly. I still feel disgusting. I still feel ugly. I still feel disgusting. I'm emptier than ever. Fame demands, and then it destroys because it will never, ever, ever deliver. And then there's perhaps the biggest one, I think, of our time, and that is the Baal of beauty, or the Baal of physical appearance. Think about this. How many TV ads or billboards have you seen that feature a beautiful, slim young woman or a handsome, toned young man? How many? Countless numbers. I was going to put some pictures up, but I think the point is proved by the fact that I didn't find any I thought I could put on a screen for you tonight. How does the Baal of beauty have the power to demand? Well, think about how these billboards and ads affect different groups of people. If a young woman sees that billboard, it demands of her that she replicate that body shape, however unrealistic that may be. And it tells her that if she does not, she will lack worth and lack meaning. So the Baal of beauty sucks her into a slavish demand to look ever better. And it's a power that in its most extreme leads to eating disorders and a downward spiral. What about a young guy who sees that billboard? The Bala Beauty tells him, that's the kind of woman you should seek. That's the kind of woman of worth and value. So it fills that young guy with completely unrealistic expectation. He meets women in the street who, surprisingly enough, haven't been photoshopped because they're a real person. And they fall short of his expectations. He stops seeing ordinary women as having worth. And it's a power that, in its most extreme, is drawing increasing numbers of men into a world of pornography, where they can immerse themselves in this illusion of perfect airbrushed women. And what about older people? How does the Bala of beauty demand of them? Well, for many, those billboards can fill them with a depressing despair of lost youth, or of youth that is quickly slipping through their fingers, and it's causing people to clutch more desperately than ever at whatever they can find to stave off this process of getting older. The Bala of beauty, it's demanding, it's enslaving, and ultimately it destroys. Because it will never deliver. It tells you again and again, you will never look good enough. It tells you, you will never be satisfied with the ordinary looking person that you've met. It will keep you longing for a lost youth. You know, we could have done that analysis on pretty much any cultural god, but all of them demand, all of them destroy. So how do we break out from their snare? It's only by seeing the triumph of the true God. As we go on in the story, Elijah calls the people near, and he takes 12 stones, and he repairs the altar of the Lord. And having absolutely drenched this sacrifice, he steps forward in verse 36. And what a contrast we find to Baal's men. There's no frenzied screaming. There's no demented dancing. There's no rituals. There's no self-mutilation. He simply prays. Look at verse 36. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. And at that, this epic contest, this grand showdown, is shown to be the biggest non-showdown the world has ever seen, verse 38. And then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood and the stones and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. And what does that fire do for us? It gives us two things. It gives us a proof and it gives us an invitation. In Elijah's prayer in verse 37, he says that the fire will show the people that you, O Lord, are God. And remember, Elijah's challenge was, choose your God and choose based on truth. If Baal is God, follow him. But he's been exposed as the useless fraud that he really is. If the Lord is God, follow him. And in the fire, in the miracle, the people get their answer. And in verse 39, they do the only sensible, rational, logical thing they can do. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. So the fire is a proof. The real God has stood up. But it's more than a proof. It's an invitation. You see, in his prayer in verse 37, Elijah says something else. He says, it will show the people that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. You see what that means? It means that the ultimate point of this contest was not to give the people an intellectual proof. So God's chief intention this day wasn't that all of these people walked away from Mount Carmel that day saying, well, that was interesting, we know which one is God now. His intention was to give them that proof so that their hearts would return to him. So that as Elijah challenged them in verse 21, they would follow him. You know, the Lord is shouting out to them, I'm the real God, I'm the real king, so stop wavering. Stop wasting all of your heart's affections and emotions on Baal. Stop investing your hope in Baal. Stop falling for the lie that Baal will give you what you really need. Please, please stop enslaving yourself to the crushing demands of Baal. He will destroy you because he will never give you what your heart really needs. Instead, turn your hearts to me, look to me as your God, and I will again flood your lives with the water and the rain that you need. Incredible. But, you know, how much greater are the proof and invitation that we find at the altar to which this altar points? An altar not on Mount Carmel, but on Mount Calvary. You know, on the cross of Calvary, another sacrifice was laid. This time not a bull, but God's own son. And again, the fire of heaven came down and consumed. This time the fire of God's wrath and anger at sin, my sin, your sin, the world's sin. And yet in the death and then the resurrection of Jesus, we get the ultimate proof, the ultimate demonstration that Jesus is Lord. But more than that, we get an invitation to our hearts. Because unlike every false god who will demand of you and demand of you and demand of you until your blood flows, on the altar of Calvary, you've got a God who comes down not to demand that your blood flows, but a God whose own blood flows for you. Every Baal in the world will promise you everything, but it'll demand your blood. And it'll ultimately destroy you because it'll never deliver. But Jesus gave his blood. He came to meet the demands. He was crushed so that unlike every Baal in the world, you can come to him and find that he does deliver. That he will give you rest, that he will quench the hunger and spiritual thirst of your heart. So the question remains the same. Whom will you choose? You know, through every age, Elijah lays his question before us again. Whom will you choose? I think if I'm honest, I spend much too much of my life wavering. I'm sure you do too. We spend too much of our lives being sucked in by the demands of Baal. The Baal of success, the Baal of beauty or of approval or possessions. We buy into the lie that they will give us what we really need. But all they do is leave you shouting louder, dancing harder, and slashing deeper. That's all they do. So will you keep giving in to their demands? That's the challenge tonight. Or will you respond to the proof and invitation of the cross? And like these people, fall prostrate before the one whose blood flowed for you. And cry, Jesus is God. Jesus is God. If Baal is God, follow him. But if the Lord is God, follow him. Let's pray.